This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 106 was recorded on February 22, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. After several weeks of focus on the volatility complex implosion, we have something a little different for you this week. We're going to take a deep dive into natural resource investing with Sprott Global founder Rick Rule. We'll discuss everything from whether thorium will eventually displace uranium as the preferred nuclear reactor fuel, to lithium for electric vehicle batteries, to whatever became of those rare earth elements that you heard so much about just a few years back. But don't worry, Patrick and I will be back in our post-game segment to focus on the latest week's worth of developments in the equity market correction, and we'll discuss the pronounced change in implied volatilities and why that now favors different option strategies.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 has really been working this retracing bounce for a while. It sort of looks like the upside has been running out of a little bit of momentum, and we're sort of stuck here in a little bit of a chop. What's your take on the S&P here?
Well, let's talk first about what didn't happen. Devin Anderson warned us that the scenario that we needed to be most concerned about would be if there was a rapid acceleration, and that would cause the sell-off to become a reinforcing spiral, vicious cycle type of scenario. That didn't happen, so that's the good news. What's probably not happening either is a clean V-shaped recovery, 100% retrace back to new all-time highs. I don't think that's likely, although I suppose it's still possible. We have only seen a little bit of turbulence here. But I think by far most likely is that we're going to see a partial retrace of that move down, and then it's probably going to roll over and test new lows again. Now, 61.8% is a Fibonacci level that tends to work very well for a lot of things. That 61.8 Fib level is at 2744 on E-mini S&P futures, and that's held pretty well so far. We've traded only just very, very briefly for a few minutes above it. So it looks to me like the 61.8 Fib level at 2744 is holding and that the market is rolling over. The question, though, is what happens next, because it appeared on Wednesday afternoon, Patrick, as though, okay, if we hit 61.8, it was rejected abruptly, big sell-off, okay, clearly, you know, the selling is in motion. Then Thursday morning, as you say, right back up, not quite to that 61.8 level, but almost to it, and I think that crude oil helped to get equities up. After the crude oil market closed, we saw equities start to roll over again, back down, testing 2,700 before the session would end. And, you know, it's a really a big question is, are we going to lower lows than we had before at the 200-day moving average? Are we going to just see some chop here and then eventually finish and make a retracement all the way back up to new all-time highs? It's not clear yet exactly what's going to happen. I think what you want to watch, though, is do we get, and I think it seems very likely to me that we see what I'll call a meaningful retest of the low range, let's say below 2,600. Does it go to lower lows than the prior low, or do we go to not quite as low of a low? It's not clear whether this is over or not. So, Patrick, I don't know exactly what's going to happen. Of course, nobody does. But if I had to take a guess, I'd say it's going to be that more meaningful test of lows, let's say below 2,600. And then probably we'll get a recovery from there. Now, of course, it's always possible that we could get lower lows and more selling. And maybe this really could be the big one. The beginning of the bear market is starting right now. I really don't think that that's likely to be the case. I think what's more likely is a retest of the correction low, and then a retracement either most of the way or if not all of the way back towards all-time highs. Let's come back, though, in our post-game segment after the feature interview with Rick Rule, because I want to talk to you some about options trading strategies now that implied volatility isn't cheap anymore.
All right. Well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index then, because in last week's show, we were right at the bottom end of that range of that dollar index. And we were talking about, you know, Juliet's views about a potential move in the dollar here. And suddenly we find that support having held and we bounced right back towards the middle of that range. What's your thinking here on the dollar?
Well, actually, we did get a little bit lower than the prior low, but some technicians are now calling that a double bottom, saying it's all uphill from here for the dollar. And I really have mixed feelings about it, Patrick. Certainly, that scenario of double bottom and it's all uphill from here, it jibes very well with what I see in other assets. If I look at what's going on with treasury yields and I look at what's going on with gold, that story makes sense. But, you know, to my eye, I guess a lot of technicians see this differently than I do. I still see lower lows and so far lower highs. We haven't gotten to a higher high yet. So what I see so far on the chart looks more to me like the beginning of a downsloping channel forming than an actual double bottom. Now, certainly if we see a print above 91 on the dollar index, that would be a different story. That would start to really confirm the double bottom scenario. I'll just say in general, Patrick, it's official. I'm confused about this. And I'm not the only one to be confused. A lot of the big banks have been writing notes in the last week or so saying that a lot of clients are asking them, hey, we're confused about rising rates and sinking dollar at the same time. And what some of them are saying is that it really is actually the lack of demand for treasuries. People don't want to buy treasuries. And the fact that they don't want to buy treasuries is why the dollar is declining. You see less international capital flow into the dollar because people don't want to buy U.S. treasuries. Well, that really implies a pretty big change. If the U.S. dollar is no longer the safety trade asset, that's a pretty big deal. So I don't really have a firm answer on what's going on here, but I think that it's going to be very important, particularly as we get into treasuries a little bit later on, to think about what some of the implications of this could be.
All right, well, let's move on to the crude oil, because after that, you know, $7+ drop that we had the other week, crude oil's been retracing a good part of that up here. We find ourselves just north of the 62 handle. What's your thinking here on crude? I mean, is there another leg lower coming here, or was that it?
Well, that remains to be seen. My base case, and what I think is most likely, is that there will be a retracement lower. But there's a big caveat there, which is it comes with a retracement in the equity market. If the equity market V-shape recovers all the way back up to new all-time highs, I think it'll take the crude oil market with it. Let's start with inventory this week. We saw crude oil expected very widely to build at least 2.5 million barrels, and it drew down instead 1.6 million barrels. Meanwhile, Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 2.7 million barrels. That's another massive Cushing drawdown on the back of a long string of massive Cushing drawdowns. The only build in the series was 261,000 barrels, a pretty small build on gasoline. That was dwarfed in the other direction by distillates drawing down 2 million barrels. Production, meanwhile, after a series of weekly rises, remained flat at 10.27 million barrels per day. Now, remember what I've said in the past. It's the numbers that are going to count, because I think that there's a fundamental argument that says, boy, this market really is lopsided with everybody on one side of the boat, and it's ripe for an unwind. But it's going to take numbers to do it, and we sure didn't get bearish numbers this week. The bullish surprise in inventory caused the market to rally straight up more than a dollar in the first couple of minutes after the data came out, and more than a dollar and a half before the session was over. Putting this all in perspective, where are we headed? What's the big picture? I do think that there's a strong case to retest the recent lows and maybe even to move lower. The caveat there is the equity market is a really big factor. The equity market and crude oil have been moving in sympathy with one another. If equities roll over, as we discussed earlier, I think they probably take crude oil with them. On the other hand, if equities V-shape recover all the way to all-time highs, I think that's pretty much going to take crude oil up with it. A key level that comes into play is the 61.8% Fibonacci retracement. That is very often with crude oil where retracements manage to get to before they reverse. We got there today, or we came within a nickel of it, I should say. After the data came out, we rallied sharply first to the 34-day moving average at 62.82, and then continued a few minutes later higher to 63.09. That's a nickel shy of 63.14, which is where that 61.8% Fibonacci level is. For analytical purposes, we basically hit it today. So if the retest is coming, if we're headed lower from here, I I think we've moved about as far up as this market can, and I think it's very ripe for a reversal to the downside. On the other hand, look at today's data. If we continue to see these bullish surprises, you know, what's going to cause the market to go down? The equity sympathy, I think, will help to start it, but in order for us to really see new lows, and certainly in order for there to be any chance of a meaningful unwind of this massive lopsided interest where we have just huge, huge speculative imbalance of way more speculative longs than speculative shorts, about a 10.5 to 11 to 1. It was 12 to 1 at one point. We're off of that slightly, but we still have more than a billion with a B barrels of speculative net length between WTI and Brent crude oil collectively. If that's going to be unwound because everybody jumping off of one side of the boat at the same time, it's not going to happen with today's inventory numbers. So we'll see what next week brings. In the meantime, I think there's a good chance for the rally that we've seen so far to be arrested, if not reversed, just because of the fib level that we hit and also sympathy with the equity market, which I think is probably going to continue to sell off. I want to briefly mention Venezuela, not so much the petro cryptocurrency. I don't think that's really important. Frankly, I think it's a farce that Venezuela is trying to perpetrate. But what I do want to mention is just how incredibly important Venezuela could be to the world market. Venezuela was producing more than 4 million barrels per day. Now they're down to about 1.6 or 1.7 million barrels per day. So just for Venezuela to go back to its full production capacity, you know, if somehow magically we could press a button and solve all of the political and economic problems in that country so that they could go back to their full potential production, that would create a glut of crude oil larger than the glut that caused the big sell-off in 2014. That's how big it is. Now, unfortunately, I don't think that we're going to go in that direction. We have so many problems in that country that a lot of people think it's going to dip below a million barrels per day. And the reason that's so important, Patrick, is Venezuela is a key source of heavy oil blending stock. Remember what Art Berman told us a few weeks ago. The oil in the United States that comes out of these shale wells really is not ready to be refined. It's too light. It needs to be blended with heavier oil before it's suitable for processing in our refineries. So Venezuela, if it continues to reduce its production, is going to exacerbate this problem. Now, we do have another source of heavy blend stock, which is Western Canadian heavy crude oil. The problem is getting it to Cushing, Oklahoma, because the Keystone Pipeline is already operating at its reduced capacity of 80% nameplate pressure, and there's no sign of regulators letting up on that. So I've heard that apparently they've been able to add some blending agents, some lubricants effectively to the oil stock that they are shipping down so they can get back to almost 100% of the original capacity, but they're still operating at reduced pressure. So this heavy oil problem and Venezuela's role in that is critical. And of course, the situation in Venezuela is so hard to guess what's going to happen next because it's a geopolitical situation with just too many variables to anticipate. So Venezuela has the potential to make a really big impact in one direction or the other.
All right, well, let's move on to gold because the correlation of gold to the dollar remains uncanny. Almost every tick by tick, it seems to be reacting to it. What's your thinking here on gold?
Well, we retraced all the way back down from those inflation print gains. You know, on the CPI print, we got from 1325 all the way up to 1364, I think, was the high print. Went right back down to 1325, 1322, actually. And now we're back up $10 to 1332 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. I'm very tempted to buy this dip. The thing is, I'm uncertain about the dollar. It looks to me in many ways like the dollar is beginning to fall into a downsloping channel, and the Juliet de Klerk scenario of it continuing to sell off appears to be in play. If that's the case, it's time to buy gold here. Take advantage of this dip. The thing is, if this really is a double bottom in the dollar and it's about to recover, the dollar is about to recover, that is, I think gold will suffer as a result. So I'm still on the sidelines.
All right, well, let's take a look at that 10-year Treasury yield because it has not let up. I mean, we approached or just temporarily beat 295 on the upside, coming a little off of that, but it really is a very pronounced trend that has not let up of rising yields. What's your thinking? Do we go all the way to 3%? Is it stopped there? Where are you thinking yields go from here?
Clearly, the question to ask is how far can this go? And also, what's driving it? If U.S. Treasuries really are failing because they're falling from favor as the world's favorite safety asset. Now, that's something I always predicted would happen someday. I didn't think it was going to happen this soon. And if that is what's happening, it's very hard for me to reconcile why gold is not just going through the roof to the upside. So if you say that this is really just a case of nothing more than, you know, the president wants to spend a lot of money, deficit spending, inflation appears to be on the horizon, that's all it is, then I don't really understand what's going on with the dollar. So again, I'm really looking forward to getting some heavyweight treasury and currency guys on the program in coming weeks. So we can ask them this question. As far as my take on it right now, it's the important question. I don't have the answer, but I really want to get to the bottom of what's driving this. Is it just about deficit spending and inflation, or are we really seeing the dollar starting to fall from preference as a international investor's favorite safety asset? Again, that's something I have always predicted, but if it's beginning, it has massive consequences and implications. The thing that I really think most about, though, Patrick, as I see this going farther, is if there is a trigger or a scenario that I can think of that could cause the next real crisis, the next 2008-sized financial crisis, it would be a massive unwind of the risk parity trade. Now, as Devin Anderson explained a couple of weeks ago, the people that are in that trade are large institutions that tend not to panic and knee-jerk react quickly to changing data. They're going to need to see a sustained pattern. But boy, we've, for the last several weeks, been seeing the beginnings of a sustained pattern. If we get to the point where this causes the risk parity trade on an institutional level to start to be unwound, that, to me, is where you get a self-reinforcing selling cycle, both bonds and stocks selling off at the same time. And as that happens, it creates further incentive for more and more unwinding of the risk parity trade. So if I really had to look at what the consequence could be of this backup in rates, it's potentially prompting that unwind of the risk parity trade. We've already booked Chris Cole for a follow-up. We're going to give this market correction a few more weeks to play out. We're going to get Chris Cole, who warned us that the unwind of the risk parity trade and other implied vol strategies is where the real risk was. He cautioned us right after the VIX complex blew up. He said that was just an appetizer. What's coming is a lot worse. So we're going to give this a few weeks and let the market kind of absorb the news, see which way it wants to go, and we're going to get Chris Cole back for a follow-up. In the meanwhile, I'll be happy to admit, Patrick, I don't have a firm opinion on where rates are going, but I'm watching very carefully because I'm convinced it's the most important thing to watch right now.
Well, thanks, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is Sprott Global's president and CEO, Rick Rule. Eric's interview with Rick is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Rick Rule from Sprott Global. And for anyone who's not familiar, which is hard to believe, Rick is extremely well known in the industry. Some people have called him the Indiana Jones of resource investing because he really gets out there and explores new opportunities in the resource space, whether it's, you know, getting off the next airplane to go look at a junior gold mine or whatever is going on. Rick has the reputation for being the guy who knows the most about it. And Rick, what I'd like to start with, you know, we have so many people that are Wall Street guys, whereas you tend to be out in the field really looking at natural resources. I think this really is a different animal. It's a different style of investing. So why don't we start with the big picture? How do you think about the world around you? Where is the opportunity? Why natural resource investing in the first place? And how do you approach it?
Well, I think probably every one of your specialists would suggest that they were off Wall Street in a way that not all businesses correlate. But I would, of course, agree with your premise that natural resource investing is different than most mainstream forms of investing. The first is that resource investing is unusually capital intensive, which means that it is unusually cyclical. The truth is that in resources, the old truism, a bear market is the author of a bull market, and a bull market is the author of a bear market, is particularly true. And that's important to understand because during periods of time when mature natural resource companies appear cheap, that is, their enterprise value relative to their EBIT is low, they normally correspond with periods of very high commodity prices, meaning that the price of the commodity is about to go down, so that the free cash flow is about to go down, so that the debt is about to go up. When, by contrast, mature natural resource companies seem expensive on an EBIT to enterprise value basis, it's normally when commodity prices are low, meaning that cash flow is going to get higher and debt is going to get lower. So it turns out that from an investor's perspective, the best of times herald the worst of times, and the worst of times herald the best of times. In truth, in the 40 years that I have been involved in the game, one looks first for commodities where you believe that ongoing demand for 5 or 10 years is assured because of the utility afforded by that commodity to society. That is where ongoing demand is assured, where the price of the commodity, that is, the price that the commodity sells for worldwide, is below the median cost of production. In other words, you buy the best producers in industries that are literally in liquidation. What that means is that you have a circumstance where either the price of the commodity goes up or society does without the commodity. And in terms of the broadly traded commodities, the truth is that our way of life depends on commodities. And I would suggest that that's what sets apart the resource business from other businesses.
I want to follow up because I think there's something else in my mind, and maybe you'll disagree with me, I don't know, but what I think sets apart the resource sector of the stock market, at least, you know, in theory, the efficient market hypothesis tells us that all stocks are fairly priced. The, you know, analysts have figured out what they're worth, and unless you have new secret news, you can't beat the market. I would contend that if there's a space where some of these companies, I think, are run by really bright geologists that know about, you know, rocks and so forth, and not a whole lot about business, particularly mining companies that seem to pay too much for acquisitions. It seems like some of the management just isn't really fully on board in terms of managerial competence. Am I wrong to think that there are probably pretty significant dislocations in terms of what the listed shares are trading at versus what the company is really worth? It seems to me like that dislocation is bigger in this space than in other parts of the stock market. Am I wrong to think that?
I don't know about bigger than other parts of the stock market. I would suggest that the efficient market thesis doesn't work very often, very well in the near term. And I would define the near term as sort of 3 or 4 years or less. I would certainly agree with you that in the first instance, management capability isn't distributed evenly through companies, and also that analytical capability isn't distributed well through analysts. When you look at extractive industries, and I guess I'm damning myself in this next statement, over the last 40 years, relative to some other industries, they haven't exhibited as much opportunity for analysts, salesmen, and financial services people. The consequence of that is that the median level of market intelligence in financial services as it relates to natural resources is unusually low. And the consequence of that, I suspect, is that, as you say, the efficient market thesis is unusually poor with respect to natural resources investments and equities.
So in terms of how you go about this, the first thing you said is you're looking for industries or commodities, rather, that are literally in a state of liquidation where the commodity is selling for less than the cost of production. And therefore, as you say, the price has to go up, else society has to not live with it anymore. And the next major thing is it may or may not be that there's competent management in all of these companies. So walk us through the process. Does it start with looking for competent management? Does it start for looking for the industry that is most distressed? How do you go about it? And I know that one of the things that you do, you've been a very big player in introducing accredited investors to opportunities to get involved in private placements in very early stage companies. What's the trade-off? If you're a sophisticated investor, I would think that listed shares in going concerns are better in some cases, and that getting involved on the ground floor might be better in others. How do you decide that, and how do you approach the market? What's your process?
I think you were part of the way along to answering your own question. It really depends on who the investor is and what his or her tolerance for risk and intentions are. Investors, that is, people who place money in the expectation of a decent return on capital employed, rather than speculators who are looking for outsized gains but are willing to take substantial principal risk, are probably better advised looking at the very largest companies in the sector, buying the best of the best when the rest of the market has thrown them away. An example would be if you dialed back 18 months ago when the oil price was below $45 a barrel. It was pretty clear, given that the International Energy Agency said that the median cost of production worldwide, including cost of capital, was $60 a barrel, that the price of oil had to go up. If you're losing $15 a barrel 100 million times a day, in other words, if the industry is losing $1.5 billion a day, eventually that gets tiring. Either the price of oil goes up or price becomes unavailable. The consequence of that thesis is that you buy the very best oil companies in the world, ones that can survive during $45 a barrel, so that you're sure that they're around when the price returns to $65 a barrel. By contrast, if you're a speculator, if you're willing to work harder and take more risks, then you become much more management-centric than you become commodity-centric. Warren Buffett famously said that he likes companies that could be run by a moron because sooner or later they will be. So the investor in the later stage company is really looking at the whole range of management and the whole range of the business. Speculators in earlier stage activities are looking much more importantly at people. And in fact, much more importantly, at the CEO and largest shareholders.
And in the speculative space, where I know you do a lot of work at Sprott Global, do you drive your selection of what kind of companies you invest on based on a macro view? For example, you know, you think electric vehicles are going to be a big thing, and so lithium is a commodity you're interested in because of its role in batteries. Or do you just look at the commodities in terms of, as you said earlier, whatever is in liquidation without caring what reason it's in liquidation, that's where you want to be investing because that's what has to reverse?
I certainly prefer that. The technology stories often enjoy a lot of market favor, that is equity market favor, narrative favor, before they generate economic returns as a business activity. And the small markets, which attract market attention because they are volatile, in fact, suffer because of their size. And what that means in the very small markets is that the small companies never come to become significant players. If you were, as an example, a rare earth consumer, if you were the purchasing agent for some technology company that relied on rare earths in your supply chain, you would rather buy rare earths from one of the larger mining companies in the world rather than from a rare earth startup that might be able to offer you lower prices. Because security of supply is of much more importance to you than anything else. So in the technology metals, very often the companies that are important to the supply are companies that are so large that the metal is unimportant to them. So developing an investment theme in the minor markets is very, very difficult. It's interesting to note, as an example, that although the case for lithium, as expressed by physical demand for lithium in the last 3 years, has been extraordinary, the same four companies dominate lithium supply now as they did before. And secondly, what we've learned in the case of lithium is that we don't have a problem with lithium supply. The world is awash in lithium. What we have is a shortage of fabrication capability to extract the lithium from known reserves and resources. So we have 200 companies, mostly characterized as exploration companies that have no lithium, that are suggesting that lithium is in short supply. And I guess in their case, it is. On the other hand, we have four companies that are existing lithium producers with reserves and resources varying between 30 years and 120 years that are frantically building processing capabilities able to meet the near-term demand. So it's important to understand, in the case of these minor metals, a lot more than most people do about the economics of the industry. Following further on your question, though, importantly for smaller companies, the resumes of the principal players are important. Really, what you're doing when you're making money in a small company is analogous to what happens when you're making money in technology. You're answering a series of unanswered questions. The industry likes to pretend that early stage mining companies are asset intensive, but most exploration properties offer the opportunity to spend money rather than the probability of generating strong free cash from those properties. And I'm tempted to say that most exploration properties properly categorized on a balance sheet would be liabilities rather than assets. It is the management team's intellectual capital and the management team's ability to answer unanswered questions around the supposed asset that will make you the money. And if you don't understand that, you will fail in early stage companies.
Now, staying on lithium as an example, do you, as part of your analysis, try to look at where longer-term technology trends are headed? For example, as I understand it, there are known limits to what you can accomplish with lithium-ion batteries, and most experts think that to go to the next level, it would be a different battery chemistry, which maybe hasn't been invented yet, but it's probably not lithium that next generation of batteries is based on. Is that reason for cause in investing in a lithium resource kind of play, or do you just say, hey, look, there's demand right now for lithium. You know, this makes sense. We can't control what the future is going to bring.
The truth is that we try and outcompete our competitors in being forward thinking. We believe that distributed energy is a very, very, very big theme. And maybe the most important theme that exists in the natural resource business. We think that other technologies will be developed. But we think that demand for batteries for many applications of all types will be so extraordinary that we are interested in lithium, and we're interested in nickel, and we're interested in copper, and we're interested in cobalt. And believe it or not, we're still extremely interested in lead. The ability to store energy on a distributed basis closer to where it's produced is one of the literally next stops in the ascent of man. Having the ability, as an example, to generate power off the grid, having the ability to actually utilize on an economic basis alternative energies, things like solar power when the sun doesn't shine. The application of battery technology in applications as small as a watch and as large as a major municipality in the Sun Belt like Las Vegas, is such that we're attracted to battery and distributed power storage technologies of all types and utilizing all materials.
Now, this brings me to another question that's something I think a whole lot about. A lot of people will tell you, look, electric vehicles are the way of the future, therefore, oil doesn't matter anymore. It's going to be forgotten. We're going to have peak demand any day now. And it just blows my mind that people don't seem to realize that electricity is not a source of energy. It's a way of delivering energy. In terms of where the source is going to be, help me with how you think about nuclear, because it seems to me like on one hand, I can make a very strong argument that the world very badly needs to improve the safety and implement better designs for nuclear energy and to embrace it in a big way. On the other hand, I can't remember a time in my lifetime when the public sentiment against nuclear has been stronger than it's been since the Fukushima disaster. So do you think that nuclear plays a big role? And if not, where does the energy come from to charge these batteries, to power these electric vehicles, and to power the rest of society?
You've asked a lot of important questions there, but let's begin with the last one. First of all, the future for nuclear energy is very bright, irrespective of the current political whims in countries that believe that they can do without nuclear power. Nuclear power has a future as an efficient source of energy on a global basis. Uranium stores more power in a smaller unit of volume than any other power source known to man. And if you look out 4 or 5 years, looking at the pace of, as an example, nuclear starts in China, in the Gulf, places like that, the nuclear industry is in extremely good shape, the doubters notwithstanding. Even in countries that have forsworn nuclear use, Germany comes immediately to mind. What the Germans have done is shut down domestic nuclear production, and they have replaced that energy really with 4 sources. The first is imported electricity, ironically generated from nuclear sources in Poland and France. The second is high sulfur coal. In other words, they have blown their Kyoto Protocol pledges all to hell as a consequence of substituting coal for nuclear. The third is, ironically, solar energy in a part of the world where the sun doesn't shine, which has resulted in power rates in Germany increasing threefold in 6 years. And the fourth is increasing reliance on Russia for natural gas. My suspicion is that even in countries like the United States and Germany that can afford irrational responses to power markets, that the markets ultimately will prevail. The near-term question about nuclear power really revolves around Japan. The Fukushima disaster did 2 things. One, it made people arguably very nervous, and rightly nervous, about the efficacy of current nuclear standards on a global basis. And from the market's point of view, it took 15 or 16 million pounds of demand out of a market and added 100 million pounds of inventory as supply. In the near term, the price of uranium will be determined by the pace of Japanese reactor restarts. We have 8 restarted now, with about 30 in the permitting phase. I'd like to go to an earlier part of your question, though, where you talked about the safety of nuclear power. If we looked at nuclear power safety from a statistical point of view relative to other kinds of energy, and we asked ourselves how many people got electrocuted worldwide every day, are we prepared to make electricity illegal? Or if we thought about the real risks associated with flammables like natural gas, and how many people die every year of various accidents associated with natural gas. If we were going to pay attention to science and arithmetic, we would advance nuclear power relative to natural gas and electricity. The truth is that somebody who makes their living from investing has to be very hard-headed, and they have to get past the narrative, and they have to look at the math, and they have to realize that over time, no matter the stupidity of the politics, that markets work.
Rick, there's something I'd really love to run by you. There's a fellow named Kirk Sorensen who tells a fascinating story. This is an ex-NASA engineer who would like the world to listen to him, and not many people do listen to him, unfortunately. But he says that there's something called a liquid fluoride thorium reactor, which was actually invented and tested like 50 years ago, which is orders of magnitude safer, better, smarter. It doesn't have the failure modes that a boiling water uranium reactor has. It's a better way of doing things. If we were serious, and I think his contention is if we were serious about safety, we would engineer thorium reactors instead of uranium reactors, and that would be the way of the future. Now, when I listen to this guy, he sounds like he knows what he's talking about, although I certainly am not a nuclear engineer, so I have no idea. Is his thorium story credible? And if so, is there an investment that play there in terms of thorium and is a fuel for future reactors?
I'm fascinated with thorium technology, but I need to tell you that despite about 15 years of study, it's still embarrassingly a bit above my pay grade. Right now, the economic implications of thorium are that occasionally, as a subject, it succeeds in selling an awful lot of investment letters. When I look at the economic implications of the thorium versus uranium debate, the only thing I can say is that the global engineering community seems to have caused about $120 billion in current financing for the construction of nuclear plants and no dollars for the construction of thorium plants. And what that tells me is that for the next 10 years, and I need to say at an 8% discount, 10 years is most of what I'm concerned about, I need to know a lot more about uranium than I need to know about thorium. When I begin to see the embrace of the technical community around thorium at a degree that's substantial enough that real capital begins to be deployed in thorium, say two reactors, $12 billion to $15 billion, then I will begin to think it's time for me to really truly get to understand thorium. But I need to say that when I look at the debate and I think about my capabilities in the debate, I'm inclined to believe that a community of 25,000 engineers worldwide has had the debate long enough and hard enough that they're willing to spend $125 billion on the uranium side and none on the thorium side. And that's as close as I can come to an answer for you.
There's another related topic that I've heard a bit about that I'd love to get your comment on, which is, aside from thorium reactors, contention that I've heard from some very smart people is, look, the problem we have with nuclear energy is that these very, very large Westinghouse boiling water reactors are failure prone. The technology is not perfect. This is 1960s and 70s technology. What you really should move to is a completely different approach of modular reactors, where these things are built in a factory, they're shipped with maybe the fuel in a separate truck or something for safety, put together, they run the thing, and you can physically pick it up and send it into an overhaul facility. So the reactor itself can be picked up from wherever it was used and sent back to the overhaul facility for servicing, and that this modular approach could be orders of magnitude safer than in-place construction of very large nuclear power plants. It's also been suggested that this would make nuclear power viable in much smaller markets, small countries, and so forth. It seems to me that, you know, it sounds like a good story. I don't know if the engineering is solid behind it, but if it is, that ought to open up an incredible equity market in terms of whoever's going to, you know, run the company that builds these modular reactors, whoever's going to figure out the transportation logistics to get them in place, whoever is going to figure out the financing for the contracts that service them and provide long-term maintenance for them. There's just a huge industry there if this story is true. Is the story true? And if so, where's the investment opportunity?
I think the story is true. I think that we need more and better technology in large-scale industrial reactors, but the industry is spending literally billions of dollars on marginal reactor technology, including, ironically, recently Westinghouse, despite the fact that it's in bankruptcy. I think that there is lots and lots and lots of room for both technologies, and I think that they'll exist side by side. The truth is that the Westinghouse technology on an industrial scale does need to be upgraded. And you may have seen that Westinghouse was recently or is recently being bought out of bankruptcy by a large Canadian infrastructure company, which theoretically will have the staying power both to enable Westinghouse as a contractor to suffer through the vagaries of the political cycle and the construction cycle, but also to put in place the upgrade in reactor technology that will allow Westinghouse to continue to be competitive with Japanese, Chinese, and Russian industrial scale reactor technologies. At the same time that that's taking place, the distributed reactor technology that you describe is something that literally everybody in the nuclear industry and almost everybody in the power industry is frantically pursuing, and billions of dollars are being spent on commercializing this technology.
With that backdrop in place, it sounds like we agree, you and I agree, that there is plenty of reason to think uranium will be needed for many years to come. At the same time, it sounds like it's very much out of favor politically now. So does this meet the qualifications that you've described earlier as being a good investment opportunity right now to look at uranium mining? And I guess particularly what I think about is I think this is there's a lot of complexity that comes into play with the decommissioning of nuclear weapons and downblending the uranium that was previously weapons grade to make more, you know. Is there an overhang of supply that needs to be exhausted before there's going to be a market for more uranium? And if so, does that mean it's not time yet? What's the opportunity in terms of investment landscape relative to uranium?
Another great and complex question. I'll try and remember all of it so that I can answer all of it. First of all, you have a commodity that is priced currently at about $23 a pound that costs about $60 a pound to make. So the industry is losing about $35 a pound. And of course, being miners, trying to make it up on volume. We are seeing supply destruction in the uranium business right now, which is always what you look for. The industry is in liquidation. And despite what some detractors might say, demand for uranium is assured because people around the world want the lifestyle that you and I enjoy. And doing that is energy intensive. With regards to supply, two issues. One you talked about is the downblending of nuclear weapons. Thankfully, this is a theme that has been happening since 1992 and something that continues. The inventory of nuclear weapons relative to the fuel needs of a world that turns uranium into watts is fairly small. So that inventory is manageable. Most of the inventory in the uranium business comes about as a consequence in the very near term of the shutting down of demand for nuclear power in Japan. The most important thing to note in the near term, that is the next 2 or 3 years, with regards to uranium prices is simply the pace of Japanese restarts. And hence, is this an investable theme? I recently turned 65, which means as an investor, I've now gone through 9 5-year periods. And it turns out that a 5-year period for me is much shorter than it might be for other people. If I believe that an increase in the uranium price to a level that covers the industry costs of capital is inevitable, meaning that for sure the uranium price will escalate from $25 a pound to at least $60 to $65 a pound, and it'll do so within 5 years, but much more likely within 3.5 years. That escalation in uranium prices, if you look at the impact that that would have on the balance sheet and the income statement of the small number of uranium producers that continue to exist in the world, means that for me, this is a very, very investable theme. Increasingly, of course, we are dealing with investors or speculators who have trauma holding stock over a long weekend because of some aspect of technical analysis or something that Trump might do, or simply because they are governed by investor expectations that in turn govern their quarterly bonus. For me personally, I intend increasingly to invest in circumstances where the answers to the questions begin with when, rather than if an event is going to occur. And I very much believe that the world is going to continue to demand electricity. And some parts of the world are going to demand baseload electricity, which is delivered cheaply and efficiently. And $60 a pound is the number that is required to produce uranium on a global basis, including sustaining capital costs, prior year write-down, cost of capital, stuff like that. Therefore, from my viewpoint, will the uranium price escalate from $25 a pound or $22 a pound, whatever it is, to $60 a pound? Yes, that's a when question, not an if question. So for me, it's a very investable theme.
Now, I've asked you so far about lithium and uranium, primarily because I personally just happen to be very fascinated by the stories of what goes on behind them. But we probably should approach this the way that you described your process in the beginning and just ask the question, what commodities are selling for dramatically less than their cost of production that the world is going to continue to need? And where are the investment opportunities relative to those commodities?
Well, certainly uranium is one. If we have a circumstance where either the oil price falls again substantially, oil at $60, $65 works. Oil at $45 or $50 doesn't work. So if we have a situation where the oil price falls again, that would be a lovely circumstance. Certainly the copper price is up substantially from where it was. We believe that an incentive price for putting copper mines in production is about $3.50 US a pound, while it sells for $3.20 a pound. Note that this is a very capital intensive business. And if you see the interest rate go up by, say, 200 basis points, that $3.50 a pound number has to go up because of the cost of capital to copper producers. But I'm still attracted to the copper market, despite the fact that the price is up by about 40%. I am also attracted to agricultural minerals markets, in particular phosphate and potash. They absolutely can't catch a bid. There's a fight going on between the Canadians, the Belarusians, and the Russians, particularly in the potash business, that has decimated the potash business worldwide. But the truth is, every day more people are born, and all of those people want to eat. And without potash and phosphate and nitrogen, the ability to sustain the population that the world has now simply doesn't work. The Green Revolution goes away, which is highly unlikely to happen. So I'm looking myself at the agricultural minerals business. Another business that I should talk to you about, although it's a little outside my realm of expertise, is dry bulk shipping. The incredible slowdown that the world economy experienced after 2008 and an amazing overconstruction of capacity in dry bulk shipping during the last decade caused a situation where dry bulk freight rates on a global basis fell by as much as 95%, which is astonishing. The dry bulk shipping business on a global basis is barely on life support. But what you're seeing now is exactly what you want to see. You're seeing the marginal companies go broke. In fact, you're seeing some of the big companies go broke. You're seeing some of the older, less efficient capacity in the business coming out of service. You are seeing more of the shippers merge so that they lower their general and administrative cost relative to their assets under management and their EBITDA. So one of the things that I would suggest to a sophisticated audience like yours is that you think about playing a rebound in the commodities business by looking at the solvent dry bulk shipping companies on a global basis. Some of them are generating reasonable amounts of free cash after debt service, even at today's rate. And I suspect the circumstances where rates double, which they have to do at least to sustain the current level of shipping activity that we're seeing on a global basis, again, represents a when, not an if question. The third place, and this is very much more difficult for your listeners to wrap, or rather to implement, is water. Water is the most mispriced commodity in the world because water is allocated politically. It's believed to be a right as opposed to a commodity. The consequence of that is an example here in the U.S. Southwest. We have taken sources of water like the Colorado River, and we have allocated approximately 130% of the flow of the river to various claimants. This is sort of hard on the river. You have a circumstance where water flows uphill to votes rather than downhill to money. And you can't allocate something that doesn't exist. And also because of the structure of the American water business, because of the fact that most of it is delivered politically rather than via markets, the rents that go to water, while they're insufficient to maintain supply, go to municipalities, and they go to fund current political goals as opposed to maintaining the infrastructure for the production and distribution of water. It is believed on a countrywide basis that we have deferred as much as $3 trillion in sustaining capital investments in the water business. I can't tell you when this theme comes home to roost, but when it does come home to roost, this might be one of the great resource themes of all times. You'll remember in California when we had our power crisis, we deregulated what the power industry could pay for power, but we regulated where they could get the power from and how much they could charge for power. The consequence of that was that the power industry ran out of power and California went into a series of brownouts. Now, what we were able to do is we were able to call up the Canadians and say, please, we need electricity. Send it to us now. We will pay you later, any price. And after they sent it to us and after they got us through our crisis, we said to them, you gouged us and we're not going to pay you. The difference with water is that there's no wires to send it through. If we have a shortage of supply in California or Texas or Nevada or Arizona or Colorado or all those places where we're going to have shortages of supply, the infrastructure doesn't exist to get the water from where it is to where it's needed. So one of the really great themes that people, professional investors, need to begin to wrap their heads around are water-related themes. Boring now, explosive later.
I want to come back to something else that you mentioned earlier in the interview, which is rare earth elements. Now, just a few years ago, it felt to me like this was maybe a little overdone. It seemed like you literally could not open an investment letter and not read about rare earth elements. And these are things like neodymium that are used to make these very strong magnets. And the story at the time was basically the whole green movement, all the windmills, they need these things. You can't possibly make a lot of really important things without them, and they're in extremely limited supply, and you can't possibly go wrong. How did that work out for people who invested in those speculative plays in rare earths? And if it has fallen out of play, I haven't heard much about it in the last couple of years, is there now a better opportunity than might have existed then?
The answer is that it worked out for most speculators in disastrous fashion, the same way the last uranium boom panned out. It's interesting that nobody cares about a commodity when it's cheap and it has to go up. Rising prices validate the thesis. So people are attracted to a sector normally when it's already fully priced or overpriced. What we learned about rare earths is that the narrative was wonderful, but they weren't rare. People weren't looking for rare earths because the Chinese were such efficient producers that nobody in the world could compete with them. When the price began to rise as a consequence partly of a Chinese embargo on exports, we began to look for rare earths around the world, and lo and behold, we found them. When the Chinese found out that some of those extortionate price increases couldn't hold, they, of course, lowered the price of all those rare earths. My joke at the time was, in junior equity markets, the most prominent rare earths were fraudium, storium, and scamium, because most of the companies that were purporting to look for rare earths were staffed by management teams that couldn't have spelled the commodities that they were looking for before they became hot. Now, what's interesting is that in the period of time where the rare earths boom turned into the rare earths bust, several fundamental factors have changed in favor of rare earths that haven't been noticed by the market because the sector is out of favor. The most important is that the Chinese are beginning to enforce environmental standards in their mining industry, including in far western China. And much of the informal sourcing of rare earths that occurred in really truly environmentally disastrous form has been reined in and regulated by the Chinese authorities, which has constrained the supply of rare earths. Secondly, technology moves apace. And the fact that fabricators have begun to see that we will be able to supply their needs for these micro materials. And the consequence of that, of assured supply, means that the fabricators have developed technologies based on materials, knowing that they had access to supply. You wouldn't spend $100 million to develop a fabrication technology for a material that you were unsure would be available to you as a manufacturing component in 4 or 5 years. So the fact that some supply has been assured has, in fact, in and of itself stimulated demand. The third thing that happened is out of the 300 or 400 companies that went looking for rare earths during the rare earth boom, 7 or 8 of them actually found some. And they've been beavering away in the last 5 or 6 years in the sort of deep winter of rare earths. And my suspicion is that when rare earths come to favor again, as they will in 3 or 4 years, 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 of the junior companies that survived will do extremely well. Repeat, though, rare earths aren't rare. We didn't look for them because we didn't get paid to look for them. When we went looking for them, we found pegmatites in, you know, big cratons and archons, places like Brazil, places like Central Africa, places like Australia, places like Siberia, even places like Wyoming and the Canadian Shield. The exploration effort has begun to bear fruit, but nobody cares now. People will care again later.
Well, Rick, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. This is just fascinating material to me. Before we go, though, I want to touch on a few things. For people who want to find out more about these subjects, I know that you have an excellent blog. You also run a natural resource conference, which I think is coming up this summer in Vancouver, Canada. If you could tell us about that, when it is, and how people can register for it. And also for the accredited investors in the audience who may be interested in the private placements that your firm does in the natural resources space, how do they contact Sprott Global in order to find out more about that?
In reverse order, contacting Sprott Global is simple. Do it online, www.sprottglobal.com, or by emailing me personally, rrule@sprottglobal.com. With regards to the conference that you mentioned, that's the Vancouver Natural Resources Investment Symposium. In my humble opinion, the finest natural resource investment conference on the planet takes place July 17th through July 20th in Vancouver, British Columbia, particularly attractive to people who are interested in exploration and the more speculative parts of the natural resource business. With regards to the blog, it's called Sprott's Thoughts. Go to www.sprottsthoughts.com, click on subscribe. It'll come to you 3 times a week. I guarantee you get your money's worth because it's absolutely free.
Well, fantastic, Rick. The price is right. And on that note, we're going to need to leave it there. I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Rick. It really resonates with me when he talked about the extraordinary volatility that comes with being a resource investor. You know, there's no better example of that when looking at the world's largest resource company in the world by market cap, which is Australia's BHP Billiton, which over the last decade went down to $20, from 20 back to 100, from 100 back down to 20, and now is trading up at 50. Now, that's volatility in the largest capitalized company. And you can just imagine Rick's point about the cyclicality that comes in with being a resource investor.
Oh, absolutely. And personally, I love the style that Rick espouses in his investing, the way that he thinks so much about just the fundamentals that drive the world and what are the things that the world's going to need. And particularly, you know, energy policy is just a passionate topic for me because it really is. The future of humanity depends on us hopefully getting this stuff right. And I agree with him completely that, you know, as much as people are very rightfully upset about these horrible, horrible nuclear disasters that we've had, the fact remains that the world really does need nuclear power. We just need to get a lot smarter about how we do it and build a new generation of reactors that are a lot safer than the boiling water uranium reactors that have caused these problems. But, you know, the other thing that occurred to me as he was talking about this and the cyclicality of all this is option strategies. And it made me sort of wonder what your perspective would be, because on the one hand, I see, you know, so many ways that you could play options here. On the other hand, these companies, as you say, are extremely volatile, which means that the options premia are not going to be cheap in a lot of cases. What do you see here in terms of options opportunities?
You said it exactly right. There's very high implieds in the resource space, which makes the options on the surface appear very expensive. But to me, just because it has a high implied vol and the option on the surface appears expensive, you have to put it as a relative to how volatile the stock is, right? Like, you know, I kind of look at it and say, like BHP Billiton, you can right now go, I'm just going to use it as an example and I'm rounding here, but you can pretty much go on BHP on a leap option that's 2 years out. And you can pay about $5 for an at-the-money option on the stock. So that's about 10% of the value of the underlying. And someone says, wow, that's expensive. But think over a two-year period. This is a stock that swinging outside of a 10% band is incredibly likely. I mean, in a two-year span, BHP Billiton could hypothetically drop to $25 if we were in a very bearish environment, or it's a stock that could literally double in its value if it's bullish. And so to me, even though it's priced at a high implied and the option on the surface looks expensive, when you put it into the cyclicality of these resource stocks, you can actually get some pretty neat leverage through the option, and yet at the same time get asymmetric leverage in a sense that, you know, if you own the equities, I mean, it's a pretty painful exercise being wiped out a half of your equity value. I mean, this is where that old adage of where do you dollar cost average, you know, there's that school of thought that says it's literally sacrilege to dollar cost average a losing position. And there's other people that will live and die by doing that. But, you know, I look at the option as a great resource for giving me optionality, which is like I can turn around and lock in this price here on BHP. And if BHP was, for instance, to lose half its value, I can let the option expire. But I have the choice of repositioning on BHP at much better prices. And so using options for resource stocks is definitely one of my favorite ways of approaching it.
Let's come back to the bigger picture, Patrick, of the equity market and the correction that is now playing out. We did actually get just barely below 2,700 briefly. We've retraced another almost 15 points above that in the time that we've been recording in this particular episode. So there's a lot of volatility here. And I know that you've done some research on this, looking not just at the patterns in the S&P, but what the actual breadth and, you know, participation of different equities has been and so forth. Give us a breakdown of what you're seeing in this move and what it tells you about what to expect next.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we had this big sell-off in the S&P 500 that was quite intense. And now we have this relief rally that, like you were pointing out in the pregame, we saw, you know, almost a 61.8 retracement the other way. And it looks like, at least on the surface, that the worst is behind us. But there's some interesting observations to make. One of my favorite ways of observing breadth is to simply observe how many stocks on the New York Stock Exchange are actually trading above their 50-day moving average. As technicians, a 50-day moving average is a very good arbiter of trend, right? And so the amount of stocks that are trading above or below is a very good sense of how the whole market is behaving. Now, even though we're at a level of very close to 2750 on the S&P, but not far from the highs, we have a scenario where only 32% of stocks are actually above their 50-period moving averages, which basically puts us close to 70% of stocks stocks are showing signs of distribution and selling. That is not healthy. You know, I would have thought that if we were able to have a robust and proper bounce on the upside, that this should have blown through 50% and maybe even been north of 60% if there was real structural buying occurring. Another really interesting observation is looking at the leadership. You know, there's this old adage that every bull market needs its generals, its leaders within there. And there is no disputing where the leadership has been in the market in the last year. And it was basically in eight stocks, which have been nicknamed the FANG stocks and the Fantastic Four. The FANG stocks, obviously, being Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. And of course, the Fantastic Four being McDonald's, Boeing, 3M, and Caterpillar. And those stocks were the leadership. They took that stock market all the way up to its highs. What I find fascinating, to use the Ward analogy, a few of these generals have been snipered off. And when we had this recent bounce and rally, only three of the eight stocks actually managed to get back to their highs. And that was Amazon, Netflix, and Boeing. The other five stocks not only sold hard, but their bounces and their rallies are arguably quite pathetic. And that is somewhat concerning, because to me, the way I look at it is, if this was already the buy on dip, the first place that you would see money theoretically flowing in is right back into the generals. And we should have theoretically seen strength there and leadership there back in there. And what we're seeing is a few of them have been taken down. The leadership is really thinning. That, to me, it smells bad. It's not what we would have wanted to see if we were trying to build a case that this thing is about to break back to its 52-week highs.
Well, that makes me wonder about some of the available option strategies that we should consider, because this game has definitely changed with more expensive implied volatility. I see this market, Patrick, in terms of, roughly speaking, three big picture scenarios. One, which I think is very unlikely, is that the big bear market has already started. This is the beginning of the end. It's all downhill from here. I think that's unlikely. It's possible, I suppose, that it might be worth hedging against that risk if it were cheap. But it seems to me like, you know, the cheap puts are all gone. Nothing's cheap anymore. So I don't know how to play that. And I'm not too worried about it, because I don't really think that's what's happening. The scenario that I think is more concerning, and where I'm particularly interested what you would say about option strategies, is I think we could be in a 1987-like scenario, where what we're seeing right now is the August of 87 precursor. It's that little shockwave that comes before the big one. And I think we'll probably get through this. I think we'll probably retest the lows. We'll probably get most of the way, if not all of the way, back to all-time highs. And a lot of people will think it's all over and done with. And then maybe in the next several months, something much bigger comes, and maybe it comes very, very quickly. I'm really looking forward to get Chris Cole back so that we can talk about some of the mechanisms of how the unwind of these really big institutional trades would look, how long it would take, what the signposts would be, and so forth. But I do see that 87 type of risk of something just going haywire and things accelerating quickly enough that there becomes a self-reinforcing vicious cycle. So I worry about the what happens if something really big comes out of left field, but I don't think it's, you know, in the next 3 weeks or something that you can plan for. I think it's in the next 3 to 6 months that something like that might happen. And the final scenario, which I'm curious to get your views on, although I don't see any way to play it with options myself, is what if this is that Bear Stearns moment where we really are headed toward new all-time highs? We're going to get through this correction. We're going to rally up, and maybe we get to 2,900, 3,000 on the S&P before we finally put the high in. And the really big downside event that I do think is coming maybe doesn't come until next year or very late this year. So that's a big, broad range of possibility. Obviously, there's no one strategy that answers all of them. But are there any option strategies that I should be thinking about that might help me to hedge for any of those scenarios?
When I approach options, the strategy you choose is very much based on the narrative or the theme of what you expect to happen. And so to build one encompassing strategy that will work in all three of the scenarios would be very challenging. So to me, you almost have to pick one of them that you feel has the best probability of playing out. And then we'd have to discuss which option strategy best fits that. So now the one scenario that I've been supporting the most is this idea that it's very much going to be a correction, and then we still have one more rally into the summer before this starts to unravel at the seams later in the year. That's the narrative that I've been building. But if one was to, let's say, have an alternative narrative, one that the fear that this is now just beginning the selling, and that there is an increasing risk of an 87 style event manifesting itself here in the coming weeks or months, at that moment, just buying put options is still the right strategy, because when you're talking about an S&P having an 87 event, you're talking about something far beyond, you know, one or two standard deviations of being priced, even at current implieds. If you think about it, like 1987, I think, was to the 19th standard deviation, some ridiculous deviation that was just incredibly improbable of occurring. At that moment, even these expensive options are cheap relative to that extraordinary of a move. And so if one is bold enough to try to forecast that that's what's going to happen, well, then theoretically, put options are still priced relatively cheap to that kind of a move. But see, that's not the scenario that I'm building. And the scenario I'm building here is that we're still going to come back down and retest over the next month on the downside. And so when you're building a story like that, then if you want to continue to participate on the downside move, you have to account for the higher vol premiums, which basically means you almost need to hedge vega risk a little bit. And so one of the ways that I've been talking with members about is just expressing the downside views with just standard debit spreads. Because by going long one option and short another, you're going long vega on one side and short vega on the other. And therefore, you're making a more directional call about the price and removing changes in or at least hedging out some of the impact of volatility changing on you. But equally, I want to just point out that if one of our listeners shares that same view, that this is just a correction and that there's going to be a buy on dip, I would argue already at this stage, the focus should actually be arguably also on where to buy the dip as much as how to profit from the next leg lower. Because if in fact this ends up proving to being just another 3 or 4 week market correction, on the other side is going to be a multi-month rally. And if that's what's going to manifest itself, I would argue that the money to be made on the downside is going to be a small fraction of what could probably be made on catching the bottom and the rally that follows on the other side.
Well, on that note, we are going to need to leave it there, folks. We sure appreciate your help and support. We got another $500 donation today. I can't tell you how much we appreciate your support for the program. And please help us by promoting the program. The more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. Registration is always free, doesn't cost you anything, only takes a few minutes. We're not going to spam you or try to sell you anything. The benefit to you is that you get our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the best content that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
Well, you'll find the transcript for this week's interview with Rick. You'll also find an interesting article from Jeffrey Snyder about not all of the inflation that they were hoping for. There's also a link to a Variant Perception blog about the U.S. and global growth multiplier dragging the U.S. dollar lower. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend or myself at Patrick Sresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening. And we'll see you all next week.
that concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.